Hello, I'm Sami Aryan. I'm the founder of the think tank for women in business and technology and the FemPeak platform, with the mission of raising women's socioeconomic status. One of the first conditions of fulfilling this mission is by making sure that we promote financial literacy among women, regardless of their background. As a woman, whether you run your own business or work in a 9-to-5 job, and regardless of how much you earn, financial literacy will help you take the right steps to secure your future and give you more options. That's what I'm going to discuss with our guest on today's podcast, Laura Birkenberg. She will shed light on how factors like education, income, and social realities affect women's economic outlook and their financial situation. Laura is an adjunct professor at St. Louis University, where her course on new venture feasibility analysis is ranked number 10 out of more than 2,600 entrepreneurship programs. Laura is the CEO of Cartel Strategies, where together with her team, they build brand capital for companies. She's also an investor and advisor at Stadia Venture and the CEO of Wealth Holdings. She has an excellent track record in the world of business, and today she's going to talk to us about women's financial literacy and so much more. Laura, amazing to have you on the podcast. We had a very interesting conversation as we were preparing for the think tank for women in business technology. You were on the first panel. Thank you for taking the chance being on it. I don't know what you made of it when we first approached you about it. And you know, I don't know, you probably thought like, this woman, what is she trying to do?
I think it was fantastic. I mean, the amount of audience that attended that as your first out of the gate was fabulous. And the follow-up that came from that, just people reaching out, wanting to learn more from all the panelists. And what I liked most is that it covered the gamut of the opportunity that we have to build, help, and support women from so many angles to have that financial literacy in order to grow and evolve. So thank you for having me on there. The other panelists were just amazing people that you're able to mine and bring to the show. So thank you.
Laura, can you explain to the people who are listening this maybe for the first time, why were you there talking about financial literacy? So that people know your background a little bit. And then this concept of financial literacy, what does it actually mean? Because I don't think it's a term that we grow up with, especially as females.
You're absolutely right. My background has always been in strategy, brand, marketing, business development. And so I've worked for some of the world's largest brands that, you know, at one point they were a startup and became a grown-up. And the interesting part of that is we as entrepreneurs all have that opportunity unless we don't have that financial literacy as part of our background. Growing up female, you may or may not have that. What appealed to me most about speaking to that is the end game. So it's the freedom that financial literacy brings. It's not the wealth, it's the freedom. I'll kind of unpack that because that's a lot to absorb. So when you think about choices that you have to make, sometimes we're limited in our choices by the need for the money to whatever it is that you have to pay for. And we're limited in choices because of the need for financial literacy to advance us. And so if we get stuck, what do we do? The more you have freedom of choice, the more you can do with your life. Educating on how to obtain that freedom of choice is really key. So the first piece of that is that education. How can we help build a pipeline for success for others? If we're on the far end of that spectrum, if we're on the investment end, that means we've achieved that financial literacy. But what about those that come after us? So how can you help the next generation understand the importance of it? And that it's, you know, a lot of times women just look at budgets and do I have enough to meet the bills that are coming in? And so as opposed to investing our dollars and looking towards the future. And so when you are able to do that, what you're in essence saying is the economic development of women-led businesses, of other women. And so what we've put in place and some of the things I'm involved in is this pipeline for success. And what that looks like is this. So if you have accredited investors that are sitting around the table looking at investment opportunities into different startups, what we've also involved is that next gen. Bring them into the room. Let them see, hear and know what it takes to A, be an entrepreneur and look at investments, because the information that we're all looking at is really the same. It's just what side of the fence are you on?
And do you feel that the reason why, you mentioned that a lot of times women are not thinking in terms of investment and wealth generation. Why do you think that is? Do you think that's got something to do with the way that we are brought up? Is it a conditioning? And why is it important for women to actually have money and wealth? I mean, from my point of view, it's like money just gives you options, right? And it's always good to have options. I just wonder whether there's like a deep-rooted reason that, you know, we were brought up that way, or do you think it's more like cultural, or do you think, you know, we talked about biological and cultural, you know, nature nurture thing. So why is it that in general women maybe feel less inclined to generate wealth?
I think you're spot on in terms of nature versus nurture versus self. How can you're born female, and sometimes because of that nature, you're brought up nurturing. And so at times, I mean, pandemic has really showcased this, unfortunately, in many ways, where the female is also taking care of the children or taking care of the parents or family, whatever it might be, and trying to work either from home and get their job done too. How do you do it all? And so I think that responsibility falls on the shoulders of many females in the household. A lot of times women have to step out of the workforce in order to take care of, where the male stays in the workforce. So that in of itself creates a gap in wealth. If you step out for long enough, you're missing that growth or that promotion, if you will. And so when you step back into the workforce, you're coming in at a lower level. So your pay hasn't risen, your wealth hasn't risen. There's a lot of cause and effect that nature and nurture happen. And so that's why I think the importance of what you're building with FemTalent becomes so real, because how do we help the self? How do we help ourselves as well as others? And again, that goes back to, you know, let's look at that pipeline. Let's build from an education that an investment in knowledge always pays dividends, right? Let's help educate, because on average, a woman today earns between 80 and 82 cents on every dollar a man earns. So after a lifetime, it certainly adds up.
Before we get into talking about, so how do you go about building wealth, and how do you go about, you know, building your, I don't know, investment portfolio or so on. So I think that we need to take a step back, figure out whether there is a feeling of, you know, and this might sound very controversial, and I wonder if some people listening to this are not going to like what I'm about to say, but it's certainly been my observation that sometimes maybe women feel, it's even subconsciously, this is the feeling that the society gives us, that you almost get penalized for being successful, or penalized for earning money. You know, I've noticed definitely, you know, I for me, the whole reason why I started this think tank and the movement, it came out of a break of a long-term relationship, when I felt that I was having to choose between my career and relationship or family life. And I ended up choosing my career. Most cases, actually, women make the other choice, right? I certainly felt that I was being penalized for pursuing that. Maybe genetically, maybe, you know, biologically, you know, culturally. If a man makes that choice, it feels like the culture and the biology give them an advantage, you know, that's a good thing. That's like they become more attractive. What I find, it's kind of, maybe you can help me unpack this, but what I find really counterintuitive in a way is that on the one hand, as a woman, I would like to feel like my partner or whatever is maybe taking me out, doing nice things, right? All that stuff, like that feeling of, you know, I'm doing something for you, right? But on the other hand, I also want to be successful, and he's kind of like, you can't have it all. Whereas for, as a woman, it's like, it's quite hard, you know, to have it all. Whereas as a man, that comes naturally, like you make money and then you take your partner out, you do these things. And it almost feels like even the, whoever that hires you, it feels like they need to pay the man more because he's in charge of the family, or he has to eventually be in charge of the family. So there are all these
counterintuitive, you know, still internal things where you feel like as a woman, you want to be treated like a lady, you know, but on the other hand, you also want to be like successful. I think that maybe that's part of the reason why a lot of women, even subconsciously, don't go after generating wealth. So I think we can't really address this problem of why women are not earning as much or generating as much wealth. We can't really address that before we really look at these discrepancies. But is there anything you can share from your years of working with entrepreneurs within the investment circuit? Do you refute what I said or do you agree with me? What do you think about this sense of like there's almost like a disconnect and discrepancy between feeling of being a woman and desire for success?
Yes, there's so much to unpack there. You're absolutely right. So, you know, how do you strike that balance? And you know, between work and play or work and home. And there's so many things there. What I'll start with is be unapologetically yourself. And so start with that. Don't try to be somebody else. Don't try to be a man when you're a woman. We all bring to the table something of value because we're all unique. And that's the beauty of people. If I took it a step further in a personal side of things, you know, sometimes in a relationship, a man will have been with somebody who is not career oriented. And because we all relate to people and, oh my gosh, I'm so like you or you're so like me. And so everybody comes together in that fashion. Sometimes then the man will gravitate to somebody in the business world. But then what has happened personally for me is at times it's like, well, he might say, oh, I've got this event we need to go to. And I'll say, oh, I have a different event. And so then it becomes for the male, well, I thought I wanted that. I thought I wanted a strong business mind and somebody I could relate to and they could get me. And then all of a sudden the table turns and he says, no, I need you to be available for this. And so then you have the tug of war. And so it becomes, what's the best match for you? What's the best match for him? And so sometimes what we think we want, we don't always want. So we have to better understand the values of myself and of a partner, right? And so are those values in sync versus just, you know, surface level kinds of things? So moving that aside and going into, you know, the workplace setting, a lot of times in the spaces that I've chosen, I'm one of a few females. Most recently, there was about 18 males either in the room or on the call. And there were two females in the room. What was interesting is how much you get looked past or looked through almost. You have to start to frame that differently. If you're in the room, you're at the table, might as well set a plate, right? You're there. So make use of it and make your opinions heard. And back to your point about the office setting or in the boardroom, if you will, you know, I need to be a strong decision maker, those kinds of things. And then when I come home, wouldn't it be great if I could be the lady or somebody could, you know, hold the chair, open the door, those kinds of things. What I think we're mixing is the fact that we're human, you know, men like this, women like that. But if we treat each other respectfully and as equals, then those lines just become blurred and they become less divisive or are less unbalanced.
I think you are absolutely right. I think the keyword that you use there is equal, you know. I think the issue is that, for example, you know, people always say that, oh, if you want to be a successful woman, then you probably need to find, if then you're the alpha man, you're wearing the trousers, right? You know, and like whoever that's going out with you is like a beta man. But why can't we both be alpha, you know? Like, why can't we both be, you know, equal? And you know, there could be times that I would like to be treated like a woman in a personal setting, you know, and he would like to be treated like a man, whatever that means to him or to me, right? But I think that the problem is that the society kind of puts that mentality at the back of our mind that it's kind of like anybody who allows their woman to be, you know, successful, more successful, however you measure success, depending on what that means to people, that's not desirable. That's not like the way that it should be. The other thing is, okay, so let's say somehow we have solved this issue in our, whether it's within ourselves, whether it's like within how we see it, or how you can't change how society treats you, you know, ultimately, hopefully over time, that with movements like FemTalent and this, you know, the think tank for women in business technology, all these things that we're working on, you know, hopefully with in time, in the next generations, they will have women will have a better time. Going back to, okay, let's say we have figured out all of those things. Now, inside you have reached that kind of peace. You know what you need to be doing to have a balanced kind of life, whatever balance means to you, right? Now you go to the next level of, okay, now I need to be able to go into society, maybe start a new business, you know, start something from scratch and build something, you know, from the ground up. As a woman, from your experience, having seen so many startups, is there a startups and, you know, so many entrepreneurs, is there a difference between how a woman would start, you know, and what kind of maybe obstacles they might meet, you know, men would do? Is there certain things that as a woman you need to be like bearing in mind, thinking that, okay, I'm doing this, you know, I need to think. Is there any way that you need to think of it differently as a woman?
Well, I think, you know, it goes back to being yourself, right? But then also being a student of brand and marketing, it's always fascinating to me, the psychology of why people do what they do. Why do they buy what they buy? And again, back to, you know, your original think tank, we talked about nature, but now let's go into nurture and self. You know, why do people do what they do, buy what they buy? So you get into the neuroscience. And so you start to apply different thought processes to helping create a need or a want. When I look at the psychology from a brand and marketing standpoint, and how does women in entrepreneurship differ from men in entrepreneurship? I think we still have to focus on the audience. And so you're really just coming back to, how do I relate to somebody else I'm talking to? And what can I do to better relate? And I like to say, the clearer the mission, the higher the margins. So the more people understand who you are, what you do, why you do it, they'll understand what to come to you for. Therefore, profitability and growth result. I don't necessarily separate those two. I think both men and women have to have a vision well told. By doing that, they're able to succeed. But you also have to target your message to the audience. There was an example of the investor room was filled with older gentlemen. The young guy that was up presenting his business was trying to liken it to something that generation was familiar with. And whether it's country clubs or what have you, he said, I'm building bonfire here. I'm building a coming together, much like you've done. You know, I'm doing it online, much like you've done at a country club. You come together for an event or a golf outing, that kind of thing. He goes, so he was trying to relate to something they might be very familiar with because of their net worth, because of their age, because of their demographic. And so I think we have to think with the audience in mind and tailor our messages so that we do relate. Yeah, so it comes back to, again, the clearer the message, the higher the margin.
I think that if we go with this notion of, in order to create a new business, you need to know your audience, could it be, remember that we talked about the concept of data gap when it comes to women? Could it be that data gap when it comes to women could be a strength for female entrepreneurs? See, for example, if you're a man and you're trying to bring something to the market, both for women and for men, I think you will have difficulty fully capturing the female market. It's just a hypothesis, right? Because I just think that there's so much data gap when it comes to our understanding of women's, you know, economic habits, their spending habits. Everything has been built with our understanding of men and their spending habits, their, you know, choices. So I think when I look at whether it's video games, whether it's like films, right? You know, anything, entertainment, everything seems to have been built mostly around an understanding of the male audience. So could it be that that data gap, if you are a female entrepreneur, so let me give you another example. Think about shoes, right? Majority of high heel shoes are built, when you look at, you know, all the Christian Louboutin, you know, like Dior, like all of these shoes, they're all created by men originally, high heels, right? And the stiletto, the high heel shoes. So when I look at that, I'm thinking, would they wear that? Yeah, like I'm thinking like can you walk in that? You know, so that's not built for walking, right? So one of my dreams sort of is like one day I'm going to bring out my own shoes, but now that with this whole COVID and you know, everything being done virtually, it doesn't seem like we're going anywhere. But you know, when I buy shoes, high heel shoes, I always need to get that shoe half a size bigger and then put a lot of padding around it, you know, to make it like livable, you know, so that I can walk in it. So I'm thinking when I look at, you know, when I go to a place where there are all of these brands next to each other and they all look exactly the same, nobody has done anything differently when it comes to, you know, making it actually more a user-friendly for women, right? So that's a great example of data gap when it comes to women's market. Apple has just brought out their new phone, iPhone 12 Pro. You can only get the highest camera quality with the bigger one. Now that phone, like how am I gonna, with my hands, you know, it's just, I'm gonna get RSI from using it. So it's like not built for women. I've given you two examples. One is in technology, one is like in shoes, which is like women's shoes, right? So I think this is all opportunities for female entrepreneurs to focus on closing that data gap and generating new ways of tackling the market. What do you think?
So Somi, what I like to say is there's a gap in the market, but is there a market in the gap, right? Mm-hmm. So we might identify things that, oh, I wish there was, but does anybody else want that, right? So is it worth pursuing? And I think when you start to look at the data gap, it lends itself to understanding the gap in the market, right? And then pursuing it through market research and understanding so well what somebody wants. It might be, in marketing speak, building a persona around who would buy this, who would want this. And I think what coming, you know, stepping back from that and thinking about it, what we have is an opportunity for diversity of thought. And for so long, we think we know what somebody else wants or needs, but we never consult them on that. So that's where, you know, the value of market research, that's where the value of a broader team, mm-hmm. And pulling in not just a diverse team, but a diversity of thought. Because each of us have that, you know, because we're unique, going back to the earlier comments. And having diversity of thought lends itself to also creating that in the imagery from a marketing standpoint. So can I see myself in that movie, in that ad, using that phone kind of thing? Have I talked to anybody who might have that need as well? So I think we need to meet people where they are and include them in the conversation, because if we don't, we're excluding. And if we don't, from a sales and marketing standpoint, you're certainly not doing yourself any favors.
I really liked what you said about is there a gap in the market? Is there a market in a gap? I just love that. I'm definitely going to use that and credit you. Really love that. But how are we going to be able to find that out until we have a dedicated platform? For millennia, all of our marketing, all of our products have been developed with a male orientation. And in a way, you know, wherever we have anything that it's kind of adapted from a male to female market, it's just making a smaller size of it for women, you know? So whether it's also protective clothing, you know, for construction industry, in a lot of industries, you know, that their version of creating something for women is just creating a smaller. The many times where, you know, as a filmmaker, I have gone on a construction site and they've given us, you know, shoes So they don't ask, you know, whether it's a male, female. No, they just give you a smaller size. Yeah. So yes, you're right. There is that, but it's partly about actually having a forum, a platform, or a place where we could ask those questions, which is why we created the think tank, you know, and we are doing all of that. But let's say, okay, so now we've tackled a few things. So to begin with, it's just the mentality of, do I want to be successful? Do I want to make money? Do I want to, you know, generate wealth? And why would I want to do that? So that's that. So once you know that you have that desire, you do that. Then it's like, okay, now if I'm an entrepreneur, I'm going to create a market or find a market. You know, how do I go about that? And the question there was, would we have a advantage being female because of the data gap with women, and can we find market opportunities within that as women, which we discussed. So let's say we've worked out both of those. Now the next thing is, how do I go about generating, you know, going beyond just my daily need or monthly need? How do I go beyond that to actually look at a long-term investment plan, or, you know, looking at actually taking risks? I've often been told that women don't take as much risk, that, you know, women are generally risk averse. And I have actually seen that, you know, during the pandemic, I started raising funds for one of my clients for their foundation round. It's a bioelectronic company. I had a much harder time getting my female friends interested than any man in my network. My female friends asked so many more questions. They were so much more cautious about investing. And if they did, they actually went below what was, you know, the minimum requirement. What's your experience been? And do you think it's true that women are more risk averse? And why is that?
It's a great question, and a lot to that we can talk about there. You know, it's funny. I teach at St. Louis University the past 10 years, and tonight we're talking about mitigating risk. And are entrepreneurs more risk takers than those who are not? And so it starts to beg the question, right? Are they taking risk, or is their whole role really to mitigate risk and say, no, I don't want to risk that. What can I do to make it less risky? So it's kind of a different juxtaposition between those two comments, because really what entrepreneurs are doing is finding ways in order to grow their business and minimize risk. So they might take a leap of faith to start for whatever reason. They're so driven or they're so passionate about something, or they want to leave something else behind, maybe their other job. So how do I take my side hustle and become my main gig? So I think entrepreneurs and people that go into those kinds of fields are always trying to mitigate risk so that they can succeed. And so that's kind of where I see it. You know, the other thing about women from an investment standpoint, what I've seen over the course of time, and so these different angel networks, so an angel investor is kind of, its name suggests, it fell from heaven, right? Oh, this money fell from heaven, and now I can, you know, invest it into my business. The minimum angel investment, let's talk about the continuum of money. It's friends, family, founders, angels, venture capital, and then it becomes an initial public offering. And on the other side of that fence, it becomes a stock, bond, mutual fund. So we're used to this far right side of the fence. This other side is high risk, high reward, or high risk, no reward. So if we're playing in that angel space, which is around an average investment of $25,000 per investment, women tend to want to put in $10,000. So I think you're absolutely right. Your friends are kind of proving that true as well. So some of the investment groups here in the States have started taking a minimum of 10. And then what women tend to do is they dip their toe into the water, right? But then their follow-on funding is fantastic, because they see what they're helping, they see whom they're helping, and they continue to put the money in. So in essence, they're giving the same amount as, you know, the standard 25,000. They're just doing it in different increments. So I love your examples from before. It's like from women's heels to iPhones or cell phones, you know, to jerseys. If you support your favorite team, am I wearing a male jersey or did they create one for a female that now I'm gonna buy? Yeah. So it's the same thing. You know your target audience. So if females invest differently than males, create the opportunity that fits their size, if you will.
Do you think that, going back to the angel investment, so tell me, in your experience, where do women appear most?
So they appear in the friends, family, founders, and then slightly into the angel round. And that's just, they're just getting into that continuum of money, right? When you get into private equity, venture capital, more the venture capital side, there's less females in those roles. So it all comes back full circle here, because what you're creating is that pipeline for success. You're allowing people to say, hey, let's allow the next generation the ability to visually see women in positions of economic power, in the workplace, in social media, in movies, and in advertising, so that we do see ourselves in what we see in the world. I think some of the movies really illustrate that well, that we can now see ourselves being played with those parts instead of more stereotypical roles. And so it brings a higher level of consciousness to marketing efforts, to brand efforts, to, you know, just human being and remembering we're equal and not something less respectful than that.
When I look at the investment world or in general in the business world, all of my role models are male, actually. And that's, you know, it's simply because there aren't, like you said, you know, there aren't many. Maybe there are some, but they're not loud enough, well-known enough, you know, they've not come to my attention as much. So one of my role models in terms of business is Ray Dalio. I really like him. I don't know if, yeah, you know him. So from Bridgewater. It's pretty fascinating what he's done because he's built it to, I think his net worth is now like 20 billion or whatever, and he's built probably the biggest independent hedge fund in the world, right? And I think it's the fifth biggest hedge fund and the first biggest independent hedge fund. So, but he's done it from what I've read from his autobiography from zero. As far as I know, it's not like he actually at some point he lost everything to the point that he actually had to borrow money from his father to pay his rent or something like that. And that was after he even had, like, he was married and had a kid or something. So it is possible, from what I'm understanding, you know, from the experiences of these people, is that it is possible to do it from zero, from nothing. But what does it take? And what kind of sacrifices does it take to do that? And do you think that those sacrifices are too big for women and that's why it doesn't happen? Why is it that we don't have that kind of role model?
Well, I think it's a shared responsibility, right? I had a wonderful guest speaker come into my class almost 9-10 years ago at this point. And he said, think about entrepreneurship this way. Basically, think about life this way. And he said, ask yourself one question. And that question was this: what's the worst that can happen? And if you can live with the worst that can happen, go do it. And so here's an example. If you're at a job and your boss is not supportive of your idea, can you go around them? Or will that cause a lot of friction? Could you get fired, therefore not be able to pay your mortgage or, you know, whatever it is you need to pay? If you lose your job, is that the worst that can happen? Can you live with that? Well, maybe so. Maybe you get another job, or maybe no, you can't. Just using that as a filter, if you can live with the worst that can happen, then go ahead. And if you can't, don't. And yeah. So I just thought it was great advice for life.
Yes. That's why I keep going back to the fact that, you know, like I had nothing to lose, you know, I came from zero. What's the worst that can happen? I'll go back to zero, you know, but at least I want to live an exciting life. And it's just like waking up every morning thinking that I'm making something happen. You don't have complete control, but you are co-creating your reality with the world, right? I think sometimes kind of like people think like, I've now reached a level of comfort and I don't want to give that up. But I think it's kind of really powerful to be able to allow yourself to stare that up a little bit, you know, sometimes, and just put yourself in that position of, I say a little bit for most people, but for me, it's always like, I push myself to the maximum, to the edge of, like, I'm about to just crash, you know, I'm like, yeah, and it's an exercise. It's no different from, physical exercise. It's no different. You push yourself to the limit, and then you take a little bit of a break, you rest, you know, and then you grow again. What I would like to be able to instigate, if I don't know if that's the right word, in other people, especially in other women, is to encourage them to do that, to take that risk, to do, to push themselves beyond their limit. You know, I was talking to one of the girls that works with us, one of my colleagues today. She's only 23, but she has shown such amazing initiative, and you know, she's just shown me so much talent that I'm ready to take the risk to get her to do more and more complex things. And she was quite worried about it. And I said, look, what's the worst thing that can happen? I'm giving you the permission to fail. You know, I'm telling you, just go and do it. And if you fail, it's on me. You know, I'm paying the price, but I want you to go out and do that. Because why am I doing that? Because I know that in most other work environments, especially in our, in film and TV, not many people would give that opportunity to a young woman at that age.
Well, I think, you know, we all might think we're going to do something great, right? And that's big. But why not just be great every day?
Yeah.
How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right? So it's that same adage. It's like, I want to do something great. Well, how about just doing something great each day? Because eventually that manifests itself into something bigger and larger. And, you know, I like to say that I play with the uniform I'm issued, right? We're all issued a certain uniform, and we all have these talents and skill sets inherent to just us. But then you can also learn additional skills on top of that. So it's pulling those out and manifesting those in terms of your passion, your interest. And because that's what gets you up in the morning. That's what keeps you going when certainly when there's peaks, but when there's valleys, that passion will drive you even further. And so, you know, we don't necessarily need permission from somebody else to get up and do what we want to do. Just go do it, right? Yeah. And what you're talking about is the opportunity to try.
Yeah.
And if it fails, it fails. But you fail forward if you learn from it, right?
Yes.
And you help the rest of the world be and see the change if you share your story. You know, I think as you're building FemTalent into, you know, this huge ecosystem, what really resonates, I think, is the opportunity, because, you know, it's an ecosystem of women all in some ways like-minded, but so diverse in their thoughts. And so how do we support one another? How do we cheer on one another? And how do we meet people where they are? And so, you know, as they say, a rising tide will lift all boats. So what are we doing to lift each other up in support of one another? And I think FemTalent is exactly that platform to do so.
Thank you, Laura. That's a really nice note to end on. And I hope to have you again on the panel, in the future panels, when we have a bigger audience, you know, that our community has grown, because I would really like to look at the possibility of raising grants, raising investment for other female entrepreneurs. Today we talked mostly about female entrepreneurs, but that's not all what it's about when it comes to things like, you know, investment. So there are many people who are doing their day job, you know, and having a salary, and they can still build a portfolio, they can still build wealth and invest.
Absolutely. I mean, again, back to meeting people where they are, we'll help them crawl, walk, and then run.
Yes. So. Amazing.
Thank you for having me on today, Somi.
Yes, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Laura Birkenberg. And now is that time again when we remember another awesome woman and her important contributions to society. Shirley Chisholm made history when she became the first Black woman to be elected into the US Congress. As an activist and political leader, she was a formidable woman and a strong role model to women in politics. Here's to a day that we see more female leaders in the political landscape and in other areas too. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or YouTube, and connect with me on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram.